So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On the show this week, as audiences return to TV studios, we ask why some productions are keeping it virtual long-term. Bauer unveiled their subscription package for niche radio stations, but is it the future for big national brands? Also on the programme, we react to the Noel Clarke allegations and ask what media companies can do to provide safe spaces. Plus, do we all deserve a four-day working week? And in the media quiz, I'll simply ask why. Why? It's all to come in this edition of the Media Podcast. And joining me today to discuss all the goings-on in media land, we have making his Media Podcast debut, Jake Warren of podcast company Message Heard. Hello, Jake. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a bit about yourself. You started at Vice, I believe.
I worked as a reporter and a producer, and my sort of specialization when I wanted to try and sound smart was extremities of human interest. Really what that meant is I got to go around the world and hang around with nutters. And
clickbait, yeah, that sounds like.
Nutters seem to like me, so I don't know what that says about me. And then ended up doing some stuff with the BBC Radio and then eventually made it into full-time podcasting by setting up Message Heard 3.5 years ago.
So your own startup, which makes a bunch of shows. And you mentioned the BBC, actually. You were in a New York Times article recently, which was a sort of profile on British podcasting, but for an American audience was all about kind of the outsized influence of the BBC in UK audio. How do you feel about their moves recently with BBC Sounds and all the rest of it? Would you look for a commission from them? Or do you think they are disruptive to what you and other indies are trying to do?
Well, it's an interesting one because when I started Message Heard, a lot of people said to me, you can't create a business that exists outside of the BBC. So, you know, the way that production companies make money is feast or famine, depending upon how many, you know, commissions they are, you know, given by the BBC. And I kind of said, well, actually, I think that's a load of bollocks. And I wanted to create a successful business that actually was completely outside of the BBC ecosystem. Now, after 3.5 years, I think I'm not too conceited in saying I think we've done that, but also I'm at the stage now where it's like, yeah, I'd work with the BBC. And indeed, I'm actually, you know, looking to do some stuff with them at the moment. But I think the BBC in BBC Sounds is sort of reflective of the BBC at large, as they do some stuff amazingly where they're really pushing the needle forward, a lot of stuff in the middle, and also a fair amount of crap is probably my honest assessment of it.
Alongside Jake, we welcome back in her first appearance since 2017, back when this show was at the Edinburgh TV Festival, and I was briefly Rick Edwards, CEO of TV indie Nine Lives Media, Kat Lewis. Hi, Kat.
Hi. Hello, Ollie. Thanks for having me.
Hi. Now, you've been celebrating a big anniversary for Media City this week.
Yes, that's right. It's 10 years, which is amazing. That's 10 years since the BBC staff started moving in. And Doc 10 got off the ground, who are the facility house that provide the studios there.
Looking back on it now, do you feel like, because you're obviously very keen on the whole development and how it's helped the industry up there, do you feel that Media City itself now feels like part of Salford? Because I did used to get that sense going there and working there 5, 6, 7 years ago that
locals kind of felt this Canary Wharf-like business zone had been dropped into their city. It wasn't really part of Salford.
I know what you mean. It has a kind of American feel. But if you think back to when those docks were kind of working, and obviously, you know, it was an extraordinary story how Manchester and Salford decided to bring the sea, you know, all the way from Birkenhead into their cities so that they could benefit from bypassing Liverpool, and the docks in Liverpool no longer got all the money that they used to charge for imports and exports. So that's the story behind it. And it's one that's always fascinated me because I think it sums up the spirit really of Manchester and Salford people, that they will make things happen. There had to be 3 or 4 petitions to Parliament. And in the end, hundreds of thousands of people came out in the street to get the Manchester Ship Canal built. And this is really the new iteration of that spirit, which is still very much there within the people. So this is a huge creative and digital hub that employs 7,000 people. It's one of the most successful regeneration projects in the whole of Europe. And there's about 70 new digital and creative businesses, and they're literally opening all the time, which is fantastic.
I guess what I'm getting at is, do you still think there's any sense that there was in the opening days of this is for them media wankers up from London?
I don't know. More and more local people are being employed. And for us, you know, when we take people on at Nine Lives Media, because we are based there, we're always looking for local people, because the problem with employing people who just come in or come up from London is that they don't stay. So when we're training people to have a kind of long career with us, which is what we always want, we really need people that are based in the Northwest. And it's so important for our country that there are voices from all around the country and that there are ways into the industry all around the country.
Well, talking of voices all around the country, also joining us today is, I don't think it's a stretch to call him media podcast royalty, broadcast consultant Paul Robinson. And Paul, I gather you are back in the presenting saddle. Tell me about Retro Sound Radio.
Oh, I'm doing a few bits and pieces here and there. Yeah.
So this, it's nothing. It's just a side hustle. Yes. It's just a don't embarrass me by talking about
Wendy
Radio.
Well, it is. To be honest, I do it at 6 o'clock in the morning because that way I can then be ready, have my breakfast, start work at 9, and do all the other less interesting stuff at 9. So Retro Sound's a new station for South Wales, and it started about 10 days ago. So I'm doing a couple of shows for them on the weekend. But you know, I tell you, can I say there's something else that's much more important to talk about on this podcast. And that is, Kat, if you don't mind, can I tell the story?
Yeah, you can.
Ooh. Kat and I first met many years ago. You were, I think, a teenager then, if I may say so. And Kat used to co-present a programme on Radio Tees called Hubble Bubble, a kids' show that was 2 till 4, Sunday afternoons with Ian Hughes. And I think for a while I followed you doing the top 40, didn't I? So I did the top 40 after Hubble Bubble, 4 till 7. And so you did that for, what, 3 or 4 years, I think, on Radio Tees?
Yeah, that's right, 3 years. Pre-university.
But it's so lovely to see you again.
It's great to see you too.
I was hoping for some gossip there rather than just a friendly reunion. But anyway, good. I'm glad that you know each other and have worked together. But the thing about voices from around the country that I wanted to ask you, Paul, was, you know, as you say, this new radio station serves South East Wales particularly. And they've said they want to be involved in the local community and events. And there's even plans for an old school action desk in the style of local radio. But you're not in South East Wales. How does that work?
No. Look, most of the programmes are from South East Wales. I'm not. They've got a few extra people like me who I think they think can add something who are not local. And look, we all know that. Look, I worked at Radio Tees. I'm not local to Teesside. I worked at Mercia Sound. I'm not local to the Midlands. It's about being part of what matters editorially to that area, not necessarily where you're broadcasting from.
Yeah, and that's interesting, isn't it? That they obviously feel that there is a commercial gap there. Because it's not a community radio station, this, is it? It is a commercial radio station. They feel that there's a gap for people who don't want to listen to the nationally broadcast stations that don't editorially reflect South East Wales.
Well, I think there's quite a gap in the sense that people are mourning the loss of Red Dragon and Real Radio that were local stations. And we think that's the gap that can be filled. And look, Capital and Heart and all those stations are fantastic. But there's very little local content. This will be 24 hours a day, determined, you know, for the market, designed for the market. Whereas if you listen to those stations, it's one show a day. So I think there is a real demand for really old-fashioned style local radio. And in that sense, you know, being reunited with Kat today is absolutely right, because that's what Radio Tees did so successfully. And I think it's really using that old ILR model and making it modern for today. But really, a lot of those lessons that were learnt in those early days of commercial radio, just not forgetting they're still relevant today.
Still relevant. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, before we move on to the official agenda then, I suppose I better clarify. Jake, for the record, have you ever worked on any regional radio stations with Paul Robinson?
Sadly, what it sounds like, I haven't, but I've been missing out.
Well, you can reminisce on a future edition of the show when we reunite you. All right, let's talk about the news. And studios first. TV studios will be reopening to audiences next week with Have I Got News For You, thank God, and The Jonathan Ross Show finally getting a proper live audience back again. Then sitcoms, including The Goes Wrong Show and others. Kat, Nine Lives produces Songs of Praise, which obviously isn't a studio show, but, you know, the church with a very small congregation is a very different environment, isn't it? Do you know when you'll be welcoming people back to that?
We're certainly hoping that we're going to be able to record congregational singing again in the autumn, but it has been a big loss. What we've done is we've worked with choirs all distance, 3 metres because of them singing, you know, as well as kind of soloists. And we've done as much as we can. We've kept the show on air. What's fantastic is our ratings have actually increased 30% during this whole period. So that's really good. And we've got a huge library of hymns. So that's helped.
Does it make a difference, though, to the show? Yeah. I suppose it's slightly different with that show because obviously, A, it's such an upbeat show, and B, if people are going through tough times, it's the kind of show they might turn to. But, you know, when you watch something like Have I Got News For You and there is no audience, it really falls flat, some of it, doesn't it? Are there bits of Songs of Praise where you're thinking, I just really can't wait to actually do this properly?
Well, the way we've always worked since we won the tender in 2017 is that we've always used the hymn library. So we have a very you know, specific precinct every week, but we've always had a hymn library and we always kind of fit the hymns into the content. So for probably when you were young and you were watching Songs of Praise, it came from one particular church and there were hymns all from that particular church. But that format changed quite a while ago, and certainly since we've inherited it. So in that sense, I think the audience hopefully hasn't missed out because we've always kind of chosen the appropriate hymns, and many of them are still congregational. Some of them are from modern choirs that are linked more closely with the precinct. But we can't wait to be recording new music, you know, and that's going to happen kind of congregational music later this year.
But it's also just been a lesson, hasn't it, Paul, the last year in like you were just saying about the values of old school local radio, there are values in having a live studio audience, you know, which possibly were taken for granted by a whole generation, particularly in comedy because of single camera comedy and the prevalence of that. But some formats, they really fall flat without that live audience.
Yeah, if you're a performer, you know, you do need some feedback. And, you know, you talk to people who were, you know, the old school variety acts, and then they start doing television and they're talking to a camera and there's no feedback. They found that very, very hard. Like anyone who has to talk in front of an audience, if you've got someone to talk to and you've got response and feedback, it's always better. It's true in radio too, or television too, isn't it? If there's an interactive audience there, you can use that to make that programme more relevant, more salient, more connected to the audience. So, you know, it's an old thing. It's still true, you know, COVID-19 or not.
And Jake, obviously in podcasting, you know, it's a completely different thing. It's a very intimate thing. You can literally do it one-on-one with just you and a mic and someone else remotely through Zoom or whatever, and then compile everything in an edit. But have there been things that you've missed doing? I mean, just the simple thing of getting lots of people in an intimate setting to talk to each other has been difficult, hasn't it?
No, I think, look, the functionality of Zoom is obviously the next best thing, but actually it doesn't quite compare as, you know, sort of being able to be in a nice studio and sort of looking into the whites of the eyes of someone that you're talking to, right? There's more of an intimacy, there's more of a sort of an energy, and, you know, you can kind of, I think it tends to lead to a better end product. But of course, there's masterful things of deceit and manipulation that you can do in any edit. So, and we've been doing a lot of those, of course, but the ability, I think, to, you know, to do more in-person stuff, you know, which is now starting to happen, is fantastic.
I do wonder as well, Kat, whether there's just something about a kind of connection with the public, which, I mean, it shouldn't matter, should it? When, especially when an audience is just sitting there and clapping and laughing and not really getting involved. But I don't know. You know, like you were saying earlier about Media City being in Salford and spreading across the country and getting local communities more involved, actually just having the public in the building creates a different environment, maybe anchors the product a little bit more in real people and their lives.
The show that I noticed it most on was Graham Norton, actually. I think it was just so flat, and he was obviously struggling without that interaction, because he's so brilliant at working with the audience. But it's really interesting that Have I Got News For You is going to keep its virtual audience as well as having a studio audience. And I think that's fantastic, because it gives options for people from all over the world to take part. And they've obviously, you know, benefited from that and a feeling that they want to kind of keep that as well as having the studio audience, which I think is positive.
All right, let's talk about subscription now, because, I mean, that's very much one of the watchwords of the moment, as we've covered week after week. But Bauer have released a paid-for subscription package for their radio brands. For £3.99 a month, you can now get an ad-free version of Scala, Planet Rock, Kerrang Radio, and Jazz FM. I'd be fascinated to know if anyone does all four of those, whose taste spreads that diversely. And you get the ability to skip six songs an hour. Paul, can you see this working?
Well, I can see it working for services which are niche and which you've got a very sort of close affinity with the music, particularly if it is something like heavy rock or classical or jazz. Whether you'll pay that amount of money to avoid adverts, I don't know. It's sort of, from a business point of view, it's fantastic, because if you can actually get a recurring revenue, a revenue every month from subscription, it's a fantastic business model. You haven't got to have sales teams going out and selling. So the critical question is going to be, I guess, how much are they going to have to spend to get subscribers? You know, the whole thing is about what's the lifetime value of that customer? How long are they going to subscribe to? Because I assume there's no long-term contract, so you can churn out at any point and any month at a time. How much will it cost them to acquire that customer? And then what will the ratio be of the lifetime value of the customer against that cost of acquisition? And I think that's where they're going to struggle, because building the customer base is not going to be easy. So as a business, if they can make it work, it'll be fantastic. And also the business scales beautifully, because, you know, the costs of radio are pretty much fixed. You know, once they've covered all the technical costs, it's pretty much going to be, you know, money going straight to the bottom line. I don't know whether the proposition is strong enough at that price point. I think the price is a bit high. We did some work a while ago with Netflix and Disney Plus, just looking at how consumers regard value for money against the cost. And Netflix is definitely the one to watch, because they're the ones who determine the market value. The reason Disney came in at a substantial discount to Netflix was because they realized that people think that Netflix is amazing value for money. In fact, they probably ascribe more value to Netflix than perhaps they should for the price point. So to me, $3.99 sounds too expensive. I think the revenue maximizing price is probably less than that.
Just delineate for us briefly why you think it's a good idea for the niche brands and not for the others then. So, I mean, it makes sense, you said, for classic rock. Why doesn't it make sense for Absolute and Kiss and Magic? Do you think Bauer will extend it to those brands or not?
Well, because I think those services are in a way not as differentiated. There's so many services. I mean, look, is Magic very different to Smooth, for example? Not really. You know, they play back-to-back music. There's not much presenter interaction. And they're playing very similar records. I think this is a bit like the old magazine business. You know, if you can segment in the magazine business and you can have something that's on those shelves that's differentiated and different, you know, if you're into trains, there are four different railway magazines. I know nothing about trains, but apparently there's different segments in the train market and people will pay for that. So if you can offer something that's specialist, people feel passionate about, I think they might pay for it. For a mainstream service, I can't see it.
You're nodding, Jake. There are some comparisons, aren't there, with running a network of podcasts here?
I mean, I was nodding at the four different train magazines that are serving me so much joy. But yes, there are comparisons, right? And I think the principle is that you should pay for something, right? And whether you're paying with your actual money or with your time via listening to adverts, if you can cater both of those at the same time and it works, you know, for one particular audience, they want to give you money, and for another particular audience, they'll happily sit through the adverts. Well, okay, great to have options.
The thing is though, Kat, you know, audio fans are already shelling out via Patreon and Audible, which many people subscribe to. They're about to be asked to pay up via Apple Podcasts and Spotify as well to their favourite shows that are going to launch subscriptions. Do you think people have enough money remaining for good old radio? I mean, you can get radio for free. It's very clearly marketed to us that way.
I think it's a really interesting one. I think that if I was running a kind of commercial radio station, I think, as Paul says, it would have to be a very specific type of music. And what you'd want to do is build a kind of a real club feel around it. So go for a kind of 360 where you're offering kind of a lot on social as well. And that's probably going to be the future of the likes of Facebook, isn't it? I would have thought that, you know, people are basically tuning in to something they really like, interacting with other people who really like it too. I would certainly pay $3.99 for Classic FM without adverts. But I think that's partly because the advertising strategy can actually be editorially led, and some radio stations get the adverts really right. And I was listening this week, I think it was Smooth, and I just found the adverts really informative and interesting, the kind of combination of adverts that they had. Whereas very often I just get bored and I just think, yeah, I would definitely pay.
Well, that's an interesting point, isn't it, Paul? Katz mentioned two global brands there. Obviously, Global will be looking at this move from Bauer, and Katz has given two very different bits of feedback. You're ballsing up the ads on Classic FM. I'd pay to avoid them, but I love the stuff on Smooth. What are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to compete with Bauer and launch their own product? Or do you think they'll stick to advertising, which is their huge driver?
Well, I think Kat makes a really good point, and that is, if the advertising matches the mood of the radio station, then your sense of irritation goes down massively. And it's always been a challenge in radio. We talked about this 20, 30 years ago, and people still aren't getting it right. Some are and some are not. And when you get that jarring advert, particularly if you just build an emotional connection with a piece of music and then suddenly comes on that destroys that mood, it is very irritating indeed. I don't know whether Global will go down this route. I suspect everyone will be looking at Bauer and seeing whether they're successful. I can't see Global rushing into this straight away, given that their whole business anyway is an advertising business, given they've now got the outdoor business and so on. You know, Global have got more muscle in the advertising market. They've got more distribution in the advertising market. I think they'll carry on supporting the advertising clients and leveraging those relationships across all of their brands.
And just finally on this, Jake, do you think there's a problem with kind of telling the audience that the ads are something that should be skipped? You know, it makes sense, doesn't it? If someone's going to give you £3, £4, or £5 to skip the ads, that's more than they're worth as an individual digit on your spreadsheet. But the message is, don't listen to the ads. You know, that's not really the content. And that runs counter to everything about commercial radio, which is trying to envelop the ads into the content.
Yeah, it does. It does feel quite counterintuitive. And I guess that's part of the difference between the offering between podcasts and commercial radio, right? Is that I tend to find the typical radio spot ad largely to be pretty inane and annoying and distractive from kind of my enjoyment of it. Whereas actually with podcasting, with it being more moving towards, you know, sort of host-read advertising that's in keeping with the style, content, tone of the show, is a little bit less user disruptive. So I think people know, you know, radio spot ads just dropped in, you know, can be annoying. So actually, you know, I know it does feel a bit counterintuitive. I agree, saying actually, look, just bung us a couple of quid and you don't have to listen to this nonsense. So it's interesting, and I don't know what the right answer is.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
In the future, who will decide how our story is told?
What swagger he had? What style? No, grim. 1770 was grim, and it's better now.
Who will be there to record in uncomfortable detail, the curious moments in history that should never be forgotten.
Well, the fact that he had a painting depicting her with five breasts in his office that he occasionally threw darts at.
I mean, that doesn't seem like the sort of thing that you naturally do because you hate somebody.
Now we have the answer, and their names will be celebrated in every country on every weekday, except some bank holidays.
The speedboat was piloted by a Womble. "Look at this and marvel," I murmured to Johnny Walker. "You will never see anything like this again."
They are Ollie, Rebecca, and Arian, otherwise known as the Retrospectors. Wherever you get your podcast.
Let's talk about Noel Clarke. News broke last week that the actor and director had been accused of a number of instances of sexual assault. Sky and ITV paused production of the shows that he featured in. BAFTA withdrew his Lifetime Achievement Award. The BBC is looking into historic allegations from the set of Doctor Who. Jake, this is all a bit of a mess. What are the sorts of questions that broadcasters and production companies need to be asking themselves now?
Well, it's a good question, and I don't know if I have a succinct and fantastic answer for you, but it certainly feels like, whereas historically this stuff was kept discreet and sort of, you know, known within circles that this person behaves like this and, you know, is pretty shocking, that clearly more due diligence has to be done in terms of the people that you're willing to work with, you know, sort of enrich and enliven their star and push them to the front of your productions. Actually, you know, it's a pretty common mantra, is it? But just don't be a bastard, you know, don't be one of those people. So I think it's probably around due diligence is the thing that I would talk about it, and historically as well, right? You know, actually, you know, you need to do that proper work as to who you're going to work with and why.
But we're talking about talent here, aren't we, Kat? And that's the interesting part of this. For so many people listening who work in so many different parts of the industry, it's all very well saying, oh, you need a stronger HR team, you need to look into what kind of people you're working with, you need to have a reporting process and all the rest of it. But when it comes to talent, the on-screen talent, it's often just commissioners who don't even know the person saying they want a particular talent and they don't ask about their behaviour on purpose because they don't want to know. How can you avoid anything about that?
I think what's really important is to empower your staff and the presenters you work with to know what the boundaries are and that, you know, they have to show everybody respect at work. So if you've got a respect at work policy that everybody knows, that's kind of perhaps based on the industry standard, you know, the BBC have got a really good respect at work policy. And then, you know, a whistleblower system as well is really helpful. Or some people are talking about perhaps having somebody on a production who's in charge of safeguarding, much in the way that, you know, we've got COVID supervisors at the moment. Perhaps there should always be somebody who's got that safeguarding role, the production manager or whoever. But I think it's just really important that women, particularly young women, because it is an issue that affects mostly young women, are empowered, A, to know what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable, and B, to just be able to put their hand up without feeling that their job is at risk. Because the classic situation, and obviously this has been going on for decades, and it's really sad to find it still going on so much in the industry, is that, you know, a young woman who turns down somebody's advances then loses their job. And it's a freelance business, and, you know, people are considered very often in a very wrong way to be dispensable and replaceable. And this kind of practice has just got to stop.
Well, I suppose the reassuring thing, Paul, is that we are talking about it because lots of women did come forward. And actually the environment has changed, hasn't it? We're talking about things that happened not years and years ago, but a few years ago.
Yes, I mean, I was shocked about this and shocked it's still going on after all of the disclosures there were, you know, around Savile and so on around that time. I was really surprised at how many people have come forward. And the irony, of course, they came forward once he was seen on stage accepting the BAFTA. I think what Kat said is completely right. I think what Jake said is completely right. The other thing I think is interesting about this guy is he was obviously very good at managing the situation because he presented himself as being a very considerate, decent person. You know, he tweeted, you know, be good, be kind, be respectful. He gave this outward impression of being someone who really was a good guy and was treating people in the way they should be treated. And yet he was obviously behaving so badly. badly. The thing I can't understand is, given the number of cases, why it took so long to come to fruition, why it came to be recognised. I'd have thought this has happened over a number of years, and I'm surprised it wasn't picked up earlier. So I do think there's need for more due diligence. It's very difficult, but you know, you've got to somehow not allow people to behave like this in plain sight. And I mean, I was shocked, for example, the stories about the explicit sex scenes, where he was writing these sex scenes and then asking co-stars to take clothes off. Now, I mean, that's so blatant. I'm amazed that wasn't picked up. So I think there has been some lack of due care here. But I think, you know, what Kat was talking about going forward needs to be implemented with, you know, a great deal of resource and commitment from chief executives right through all of the editorial staff.
I was just going to chime in with saying that I think with this particular case with Noel Clarke, it's, you know, obviously there's been a culture for so long, you know, since the dawn of time, that big stars equal sometimes being nasty people. But actually what I think it's also indicative of is that the marquee talent, the star, has also got more and more power behind the scenes now. So he's a writer, he's a director, he has his own production company. He's involved in every facet of a production, which means that not only would you be on the big silver screen next to him, but he's also the conduit to your opportunity to be there, which gives him a lot more power to then in turn abuse.
I suppose as well, Kat, it's about other people on the set with that kind of power recognizing the power they have. I think in particular with actors, there's almost a kind of endemic self-depreciation where, you know, oh, I'm just here to do the lines, you know, I'll mess about on set. Whereas actually you are powerful there because you're on screen against most of the people that are behind the scenes.
In my experience, when it gets really dangerous is when people have power but no responsibility. And that's when it becomes really, really difficult. I think what Jake said, and Paul as well, but is absolutely right. I think that when we have people that are running their own production companies, they're kind of doing every job. What's even more important is that those respect at work guidelines are kind of, it becomes an absolute must that they're rolled out to everybody at the beginning of a production, and that there is somewhere that people can very quickly make a complaint, because that's going to change everybody's behaviour on that particular production, you know, in a heartbeat, and it just should be standard practice.
Well, I mean, hopefully the embarrassment, at least, that Noel Clarke's been through would be enough to put off some people from doing anything similar right now. Let's talk about social media now, because the audio-first app Clubhouse has finally launched on Android, in the US anyway, after over a year of being solely on Apple's iPhones. Jake, you run a regular Clubhouse session for podcasters. I still haven't been bothered to go in. Someone did send me an invite. I just don't. There's just too much content for my ears out there. Have you noticed a spike, though, of people joining through Android?
Well, I have to say, I do, but it's almost like I did now, is the
right.
Honest answer.
Moment's passed.
For me...
Is it over? I'm glad I didn't bother trying it.
Yeah, it's... look, I think as a concept, it's great, but I think it also... As much as I didn't want it to be, I think it is a fad. But Clubhouse specific, and that's just because I think they got the premise right, but the execution wrong. And I was, I don't want to say I was an early adopter, but you know, I was on there maybe a couple of months before a few different people, you know, before perhaps more people joined. And you know, even the data shows, I think it was February, there was 9 million new users. In March, it was sort of 4 million. And then, you know, you're getting towards April and suddenly it's 900K. And, you know, it launched Android the other day to basically no fanfare, which is really interesting. You know, all of the Twitter spaces and, you know, Spotify buying Locker Room and, you know, they've kind of, their moment in the sun where they had a bit of runway has gone. And I think they kind of fluffed it by... The way that it was basically just people pyramid selling. I mean, that was basically what it is. It was like sieving for gold, right? I created a club along with someone else who works in the industry at a similar company, because, you know, all of the podcast and audio specific stuff was all, you know, it was done in America, right? And they sneeze, we catch a cold. They're always further ahead. So I was getting very tired at trying to stay up at 1 a.m. to listen to people that I wanted to hear talk or contribute. So we thought, okay, we need a UK European one. So we set it up and, you know, look, there's like 5,000 people in that club and, you know, there's still rooms ongoing in it, but it feels the excitement has gone from it, because it's just, you have no way of curating it yourself in terms of what you see and what's presented to you. So ultimately, you can't cut the wheat from the chaff, and there's a lot more chaff than there is wheat.
Well, also, it makes sense, Kat, as a business for Clubhouse and for Spotify and Facebook and whoever wants to imitate them to own all of that real estate with all of that conversation. But I've always wondered whether it really makes sense for individual contributors. You know, I've been invited a couple of times to participate in people's Clubhouse. Of course, there's no fee, but there's also no audience. I mean, it's one thing to do something promotionally if you think people are actually going to be listening to it. But I mean, you sort of think, what's the business model for the? It's all relying on people's goodwill, basically.
I mean, I've been invited, but like you, I haven't actually joined in, so it's probably not something that I can talk about a great deal. But what I would say is that the one thing that I would say is I think there is something in the concept of getting together with other like-minded people, as we were talking about before. And I would see it as more of a kind of spin-off from something like Classic FM, where you actually are enabling, you know, the fans of that particular channel to get together and talk about it, you know, perhaps curated, you know, perhaps, you know, after particular events. But I think that there is a kind of a concept there that's good, which is people wanting to talk to other like-minded people. But that whole kind of idea of just it being absolutely open and there being no clear kind of way, as you say, Jacob, separating the wheat from the chaff, is just everybody's too busy, aren't they?
I suppose one thing, Paul, maybe that it did have, I'm talking past tense now, does have, I'm following Jake's lead, is that it does have less of a sort of nerdy, quite male-dominated stigma around it than perhaps other fan forums do. I'm thinking of things like, I mean, in this industry, something like Digital Spy or Reddit. You know, they reek of kind of young men, basically. Whereas, I mean, it did seem to me like Clubhouse was quite open, theoretically, anyway, if you get past the exclusivity of the invitation.
Yeah, no, I agree. But I think really everything's been said. At the end of the day, its proposition just wasn't strong enough. Executionally, it was very weak. I think it was staying invitation only to try and give this sort of sense of exclusivity. But ultimately, you know, we're all time constrained. And I got invited once, didn't really find it very rewarding. Haven't bothered since, have turned down all subsequent invitations. I just don't think its proposition is strong enough to draw us away from other means of communicating with people.
Okay, Vice Media Group is being lobbied hard to become the first newsroom in the UK to allow a 4-day working week with no reduction in pay. Jake, this is your old stomping ground, isn't it, Vice? We were talking about that. Can you see it working?
In theory, I could see it working because, you know, if you trust talented journalists and content creators to create great stuff, and it should be based around deliverables rather than, you know, what's your productivity sitting at your laptop all the time. You know, Vice, and I don't know because I haven't worked there for a long time, and indeed worked mainly out of with the American offices rather than the London one, but it was very much a culture of, you know, if you get up to leave your desk before 7 p.m. people are looking at you like, oh, you're brave. You know, they deserve it for one reason alone, and that is my greatest Vice anecdote, which I will give to you, which is when I was leaving the office one time in the UK, you know, it's in Shoreditch, I was walking out the sort of lobby area, and it was me and just a temporary security guard, you know, someone who didn't know who anyone was. He was just there doing doing his job. And the CEO and founder of Vice, Shane Smith, was walking into the building as I was walking out. So I held open the door, and he looked me in the eyes, and he looked the security guard in the eyes, and he threw his hands in the air and he said, "Daddy's home." And to be honest with you, I walked out of that building, and, you know, Vice deserve whatever they, whoever works there deserves whatever they can get after experiencing something like that. I think it's, a 4-day working week makes sense if you, as long as you can ensure the quality of your output and great stories. And they have some amazing people that work there, and they do some great work. So I don't see why it wouldn't work.
Paul, you've done a lot of consultation. I don't know if you say "Daddy's home" when you turn up, but is this something that you recommend when you work with media companies?
I don't say "Daddy's home." I say "Granddad's here."
I think Uncle, surely Uncle Paul.
Uncle Paul, there you go. Thank you. That's very kind. I think there's two points here, isn't there? One is, can the business operate and do what it wants to do? And I'm a little bit sceptical about whether pre-planning will enable you to be effectively having editorial staff working 4 days, not 5 days or 7 days. I don't know how that's quite going to work. So I think there's the issue about whether it works for the company. But I mean, just thinking about the other side of this, the argument as to why you might do this to your staff, you know, if it's going to help with stress, it's going to help with mental health, that that's obviously very good and something you should be encouraging. But I just wonder, I mean, you know, I think if you're working 4 days, not five, your inbox and your email is going to be even worse when you come in. You know, you're going to be more stressed. I tend to do email on Sunday night just so I don't get stressed on Monday because I have 2 days not doing email. When you're away for 3 days, you know, getting back into it is a lot harder. I'm not sure whether it's going to work for people either, because I suspect what will happen is if you're doing a 4 day week, you're still going to be bothered on the fifth day or bothered on the weekend because there'll be something that will come along. Now, and the other point is if it works for Vice, that may be great. And if it works for Vice, fine. But I'm not sure it's going to work for lots of businesses, particularly media businesses, particularly when they're operational and they're delivering content or they're delivering a service 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I'm not sure whether 4 days is even the right thing for the employees.
How would you feel about it at Nine Lives, Kat?
Well, I'm really pro people being able to work part-time. And the example that I give is my friend Neil Butler, who created Come Dine With Me, which is one of the most successful TV formats on a two-day week. And she always says that it was because she had her kind of, you know, her mind kind of open and free and feet in the real world, as well as kind of in a kind of television environment. Because I think if you're creating, it can be incredibly helpful to be able to work part-time. But obviously it has to work financially with my CEO head on, you know, the idea of like, oh yeah, everybody's going to do 4 days a week, but we're going to pay them the same. So everybody's getting a, you know, a big wage rise. And I don't know whether that will work. But, you know, in my business, if people want to work part-time, they can work part-time. And that's the way that I've set it up from the start.
I wonder whether it will affect the unionisation of journalists as well, Jake, because some employers will look at Vice's staff who were only unionised back in 2019 and think, well, this is exactly why we don't want to encourage a union in our workplace. You know, they said they wanted certain things. Now they're asking for something else.
Yeah, look, it's tough. And, you know, my colleagues who may well be listening to this, I'm sure, will be banging on my door going, well, let's have the 4 day week then, you know. But I think it's you know, further to what sort of Paul was saying, it's there's the administrative issues of not having enough time to deal with things, but then there's also the creative issues, right? And that is that, you know, as a union, but also as a both as an employee and an employer, you know, you need to have the time, the bandwidth, the headspace to think about creative things. And if you're doing something that is a month-long project rather than just a Tuesday from 8 to 4 p.m. project, actually maybe having that little bit more time independently will give you the, you know, the greater headspace and the greater conditions in order to do your job better. If you do your job better, you're going to get a better end product, which is going to make your employer more happy. So, you know, you can make many different arguments for and against it. I think it's something that deserves to be experimented with.
And Kat, I'm curious about, you know, what you were saying in terms of people's mental health and people's being rooted in the real world before they come back into work being a positive, obviously. I wonder if what Paul mentioned about kind of being always on electronically is actually more crucial now to whether or not it's a 4 day week or a 5 day week or a part-time schedule. Would you encourage your staff to just turn off their messaging apps in the evening? Because, you know, your personal mobile phone number and the WhatsApp associated with it and the Slack associated with it, that can keep pinging all night long, can't it, even if you've got a day off?
I actually have in all our contracts that if you receive an email, unless it's an urgent matter in relation to production, in which case it should be marked as such, you know, you're not expected to answer it. And I think that's really important. I think people need to be able to switch off. And as an employer, you have to encourage your staff to switch off, because it is really important for productivity as well as for their mental health.
The problem is, how do you know absolutely sure that it is or isn't an urgent email without reading it and scanning it first? And then your brain's immediately taken to that place, isn't it?
I think it's the person, the people that send it. I think generally there should be a culture where people don't carry on sending emails all through the night. And, you know, and we all know some people do that. But I think generally as an employer, you can encourage people not to do that, because it's not a great thing to do unless it is really urgent. So
I suppose it's about scheduling people's conveniences, isn't it, Paul? Because you sort of don't want to tell the person who's ordered their life and is very happy sending off WhatsApp messages at 11 p.m. because that's when they're, you know, in a very fertile brain space. You want to tell that person not to do that if it's helping them achieve things. But you've also got to be very clear to the person receiving it. They don't have to respond.
Yeah, I mean, there are people you work with who, they go down their to-do list and they check up all the emails or WhatsApp messages, and then they think, all right, I've done all that, I can cross it off, now I'm free, I can switch off. But of course, that creates a problem down the line for somebody else. The other issue, of course, is we're now working, in a global world, and I'm in the morning, I'm doing my stuff to Asia. In the afternoon, I'm doing my stuff to America, and holidays are different. I always pray for Thanksgiving because that means there's nothing from America on that day. That Thursday is always quiet. We are in a global 24 hours business. So I think what Kat said is right. It's how do you tell when it's important? And if you're a producer or anybody involved in a business and there's something really urgent, you'd want to know and you'd want to deal with it. If it's not urgent, it can wait till Monday morning. And I think it's about making sure you flag that. If it is urgent, I think everyone's okay about being disturbed occasionally if it's urgent, but not on a regular, recurring basis.
Okay, talking about a pay-related issue at BBC News now, presenters there are being paid big money by businesses to host events, according to a recent report by The Guardian, which we kind of knew, Paul, didn't we? Because this is a fix, isn't it? We know about it because there was a fuss in the past about presenters, and now they have to declare it.
Yeah, exactly. And we're talking about people like Andrew Marr and Justin Webb. Andrew Marr earns the rather eye-watering salary of £360,000 a year. I mean, to me, there's three main points here. First of all, what does the BBC contract say and what are they allowed to do? It seems to me that doing work on BBC premises in BBC time for third parties when you're paid extra money is probably taking the mickey a little bit. I know it's more difficult in the COVID-19 environment.
Yeah, so let's just be specific about that example. So it was Andrew Marr, wasn't it? It was screen grabbed by The Guardian.
Yes, Andrew
Earning
Marr.
£5,000 for, was it a bank or something, some city thing? And he was wearing his lanyard, sitting in what was clearly a BBC meeting room. You do just kind of think, God, just go across the road to the hotel, pay £200 for a room, do it there.
Well, there are places you could go to, and I think to do it from the BBC offices so blatantly is really wrong. It's Brew and Dolphin, who are a wealth management company. But my point about that is, my worry is not so much that. I think that's probably just a bit indiscreet and a bit naughty. But what happens if there's a major story with Brew and Dolphin? Say, for example, there's a major scam about wealth management. Maybe some, stars have had their money, they've been ill-advised about their wealth, and there's been some sort of news story. And then Andrew Marr has to actually interview someone. He's completely compromised in that situation. So to me, it's about risk management. My worry about this with BBC News is, if these presenters are talking to all these outside companies and then those companies come into the news, what happens? You can't possibly have Andrew Marr handing that interview. And if you've got all your presenters all doing different things, managing that and deciding who does what story becomes completely unmanageable. So I think that's the issue. It's more about reputation and trust of BBC news anchors and the risk they may be compromised as a result of a future story that they're not aware of at the time they undertake the project.
And of course, we should stress that Paul's example is purely hypothetical, in case Brew and Dolphin's lawyers are listening. But Kat, everyone's compromised by something, aren't they? I mean, there are certain kind of conflicts of interest that you kind of have to declare, I used to be the president of the Young Conservatives or whatever. But I mean, actually, you might have your mortgage with NatWest and then be reporting on NatWest. You might have shares in a company and not declare that. I mean, at what point do we just trust journalists to do their job?
I think what Paul said is right. And I think the difficulty is that if you're hosting an event, then that's taking a public position with that particular company that many people witness and is probably all over social media as well. So I think it is a compromise. I think these people are paid a lot of money, and that the integrity of BBC News particularly, but also other news channels, it's incredibly important, and therefore it should be in their contract that they're not allowed to do it. And certainly in our presenters' contracts, that for the programmes that we make, particularly with the BBC, we do have clauses so that any commercial opportunities need to be talked about to make sure that they don't compromise the programmes that that person is associated with. However, I think with news, it's about the integrity of BBC News is something that's of fundamental importance, us all within the country. It really is.
I agree with that, because I think there's a difference here between, Graham Norton, say, or someone on a commercial channel. The BBC is public money paid for by the licence fee. And I think her expectation is to have an impartial, quality news service, which I think is central to what the BBC is about. I think the news is really, you know, at the heart of what we want the BBC to do, apart from all the other things. And I think we need to know we can trust those people and they're beyond reproach. And I think this puts it at risk. And that's the problem.
Would you make that same distinction, Jake? Because one of the things that's really come into criticism is specialist presenters hosting events that are about their specialism. So Spencer Kelly from Click, for example, presenting a seminar for Cisco. But then equally, it would sort of be bizarre to say to a tech company, who are you going to get for your conference where you can't have the best known or second best known tech journalist in the country because he works for the BBC? I mean, that is his specialism. He does know what he's talking about. That's what they're paying for. And it's also what viewers trust.
Well, I think, first of all, I enjoyed the story because I've often thought to myself, if I had a pound for every Zoom call I had ever done, how much would it be? And now I know it's exactly what Andrew Marr gets paid to do one. So I enjoyed that. But no, look, I think, you know, like Kat and Paul said, if you work for the BBC, it's not a bad gig. Look, getting 360 grand a year from our pockets is a pretty good deal in most people's eyes. And I think that actually, you know, you can't have your cake and eat it. And the fact is that if you agree to work for the BBC, you are also agreeing that you are being funded by your listeners or by your watchers, the people that pay. And therefore, there has to be a commercial consequence to that. And that is in the same way that MPs are not supposed to, right? You should not be doing side hustles, side gigs in order to, you know, to make as much money as you can, because you've accepted you are working for the BBC. So
But the terms that you've accepted you're working for the BBC on might not be the same as Andrew Marr's. I mean, I present a show for the BBC. I could not live on the salary I get for presenting a show for Radio 4. I mean, I actually couldn't. So, but it's not a news program. So do you make that distinction then? It's just like, if you're a freelancer, it's different. If it's not news, it's different. Should the BBC be paying me more? Yes, please.
Well, so if you're a freelancer, of course it is. You know, you're free to do whatever you want. I think that there has to be and I was putting it in simplified terms, right? But I'm talking about if you're a big and marquee name, and that sounds like I'm being disrespectful to you and your BBC Radio 4 show, which I'm not intending to be. But, you know, funny. I think that there's, like you said, there has to be context and the nuance to it, right? Which is that if you are working in something which is, you know, investigative or news reporting or something like that, where there could easily be a conflict of interest somewhere down the line, then there has to be some sort of parameters at which you go, actually, if you're one of the marquee names and you're being paid a shed load of money by the general public, you can't just do things which feel slightly disingenuous or off.
All right, let's move on to talk about ITV, where things are looking up. They told the market this week that they expect a bounce in ad revenues up to 90% year on year for June, as the Euro Football Championships finally get underway. Paul, 90% is incredible. I mean, it would normally be incredible, obviously, but it does, well, does it say more about how dire last year was, really, rather than how great the bounce back is?
Well, be careful. 90% of what? You know, 90% of nothing is still not very much. So you've got to be very careful with percentages. I was reminded, actually, going back to the launch of Channel 5. If you remember Channel 5 and Dawn Airey, who was the original controller of Channel 5,
she's the
three Fs, right? And this is two of the Fs, isn't it, effectively? and these two Fs are going to save ITV. So I thought that was quite interesting.
So and that's Love Island.
Yes, I'm making Love Island one of the Fs
and
the sport being the other F. Yes, there's obviously no movies involved, films. Look, I mean, advertising tends to be a barometer of the economy. And if we believe all the figures we're seeing, it looks like the economy is going to bounce back quite quickly. Certainly the data we've had so far has been pretty encouraging. If the economy bounces back and people are back out doing things, and I expect next week's going to be very, very busy with everyone able to go and eat inside and go to pubs and bars and cinemas and theatres opening, I suspect that's going to encourage brands to come back. If you look at what's happened over the last few months, it's the brands that have been absent from TV advertising, and they're all going to come back now because consumers are ready to spend. And I've also seen some very interesting research which suggests that there's this pent-up spend. People want to go out and spend. They're going to probably spend more than they would have done otherwise. So it's not surprising ITV is going to do very well. I suspect ITV will get back to where it was fairly quickly, and I'm not hugely surprised by this.
Have you seen a resurgence in brands working with you as well, Jake? Because branded podcasting is part of what you do, isn't it? Do they have money saved up for advertising that they haven't been spending?
They do. And, you know, podcasting has been one of those industries which has not been a victim to the pandemic, right? It's boomed and it's accelerated. And we've experienced that as a business. And I think, you know, part and parcel of that is, you know, we've done things to adapt from it the event, the conference, you know, the sort of marquee thing in person hasn't existed for the last year and a bit. And actually, like most people, if you're a CMO or a, you know, a head of brand partnerships or something like that, you get to the end of the financial year and if you haven't spent your budget, okay, well, we know how much to deduct from next year's budget, right? So people are trying to be innovative and clever of and how they do it. And a podcast is a pretty good way for a brand to do something in a coronavirus world that still is adding value to what their, you know, their mission statement, what they're trying to do. So I've actually experienced it's been pretty good going. But of course, that is at the expense of more traditional events and such and such.
Well, exactly. Something's always at the expense of something else, isn't it, Kat? And you wonder for ITV, which is actually quite a broad business, you know, yes, people are going to be watching the Brit Awards last week, wasn't it? European football, the Olympics. I know that's BBC, but nonetheless, there's lots of live events going on. That plays into ITV and advertising live. But then you'd think they're going to be losing some of their box set audience, some of their online audience. They've got BritBox to worry about. You know, the online viewing buried in these statistics has started to dip. So is this really such great news for ITV? Are they just taking the audience and putting them somewhere else?
I think for all our PSBs, you know, it's the kind of audience that they get through having the prominent position that they're given, you know, and have had traditionally is what's most important. That's my understanding anyway. I'm not an expert in commercial television, but what I do know is that whenever there is a recession and those, you know, the advertising spend gets hit and those commercial channels suffer, then we all suffer, you know, so it's just fantastic news for the whole sector that advertising revenues are going up.
Okay. All of which brings us to the highlight of any edition of the show, the media quiz. This week, it is entitled, Why? Just why? I will share three things that have happened this week, and you just explain why they're of note. Now, I don't think Rick Edwards did this, Kat, so let me explain how it works. You buzz in with your name when you know the answer. So, Paul, you will say...
Paul.
Kat, you will say...
Kat.
And Jake, you will say...
Jake.
It's best of three, so let's play... Why? Here's story number one. Why did Kath Viner travel to Manchester on the 5th of May?
Kat.
Jake.
Ooh. Kat got in there first. Kat.
For the 200th anniversary of The Guardian. So she's correct. The current editor and they unveiled a plaque on Cross Street.
Absolutely right. Here's story number two. Tell me why did the BBC censor an Australian Paul. Episode of RuPaul's Drag Race? Paul.
This is to do with Anita Wiglet, who was one of the drag queens.
Said with such authority.
Who, Anita Wiglet, and it's a thing called the Snatch Game, which we'd call Blankety Blank. And she did an impersonation of Queen Elizabeth II, and she made some comments about Prince Andrew, and the BBC believed that they were going to be offensive, so they had them edited for the UK version. It's an Australian version of RuPaul's Drag Race.
Okay, well, here is question number three. Why... is the world of Alan Partridge slowly turning into reality?
Kat.
Kat.
Because there's a new DAB radio licence being given to what could become the real Radio Norwich.
Close enough. You were so close. North Norfolk Digital. Norfolk, yes.
Sorry.
Radio Norwich is, of course, his previous place of employment. Yes, a real North Norfolk Digital is coming to Norfolk, according to Ofcom's latest announcements of new radio services, which means you've won the quiz, Kat.
Wow, that's amazing. That's a first.
Yeah, so relaxed about it, but you did it, made it through. Jake, that was a poor performance, but it was your debut.
Yeah, apologies.
I'm just talking about the quiz, not generally. You're very welcome to have you on the show. Have you been watching Alan Partridge, the latest series?
Yes, I have. I love Steve Coogan. He actually... started his TV career on a show I used to produce. It was called Up Front, presented by Anthony Wilson, and he was the comic in the middle. He used to do a funny turn in the middle of this Friday night kind of crazy debate, and Caroline Ahern was the other
wow.
comic. They've both done so amazingly well. But no,
not as stand-ups, in character? Really?
They used to do different characters. So yeah. Caroline Ahern developed Mrs. Merton on the show, Steve did lots of different characters, but then developed. I always think Alan Partridge is based on Richard, you know, from Richard and Judy this morning, Richard Madeley.
That seems to be, it's becoming more evident, explicit, I would say.
Because he was there, of course, at the time at Granada. But no, in terms of the show, I'm not 100% sure, but I know loads of people love Alan Partridge, but I've watched it and I'm not 100% sure. What do you guys think?
don't get me wrong, love Alan Partridge, grew up with Alan Partridge and even enjoy the new stuff. The films, slightly less so. But the greatest thing that Alan Partridge has contributed to society, in my humble opinion, is the Twitter handle Accidental Partridge.
I've been on that a couple of times.
That is heaven. You know, when some politician tweets the most Partridge-esque thing and they just quote tweet it with Accidental Partridge. God, I love that.
It's impossible to do a local radio poll on Twitter without sounding like Accidental Partridge. As you'll learn, Paul, if you haven't already.
Oh, we don't do that on Retro Sound, but Hubble Bubble, maybe.
Well, we'll have to go back through the archive and discover that for ourselves. But that is it for our show today. My thanks to Kat Lewis, Paul Robinson and Jake Warren. The Media Podcast is totally independent, so if you can afford to do so, why not bung us the price of a coffee if you have enjoyed the show? But, you know, like an expensive coffee that you'd order through a posh app. And, of course, follow us to hear new episodes when they drop on your podcast app of choice. You can subscribe at podfollow.com/themediapodcast. I've been Ollie Mann. The producers, Matt Hill and Peter Price. It was a Rethink Audio and BPM production. We'll see you in a fortnight.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.